Where is he getting these baboons?
I
Every time you turn around, there's another baboon in the laboratory.
Yeah, you got a feel for him. Yeah. I would, like there is like a tiny bit of explanation because he works for this research lab, so maybe he's like getting them through the lab. But you would think at some point they're like, we're spending thousands of dollars on these baboons that he's killing. Like they would probably stop approving that, him using them for the experiments.
Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. I'm your host, Vincent Hannum, and together me and Matt talk about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between, all strange beasts are welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes.
I think you're making a mistake. I think you really want to talk to me.
Sorry, I have three other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yeah, but they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
They say they are.
Yeah, but they're lying.
There is a limit, even to the imagination.
Human teleportation, molecular decimation, breakdown, and reformation is inherently purging.
Where our greatest creations meet our deepest fears.
Something went wrong, Seth. When you went through, something went wrong.
You are about to go beyond that limit.
Those weird hairs that were growing out of your back, I had them analyzed. But they were definitely not human.
If you saw how scared and angry and desperate he is.
I'm sure Typhoid Mary was a very nice person, too, when you saw her socially.
No!
You're afraid to be destroyed and recreated, aren't you?
You're changing, Seth. Everything about you is changing.
Oh, no. What's happening to me? Am I dying?
I want to know what's going on.
What does the disease want?
It wants to turn me into something else.
Oh, no. A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone.
Don't go back to it.
Could be contagious.
I'm afraid!
Don't be afraid!
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
All right, listeners, campers, the world over. Here's what we got going on for you this weekend. We are talking about The Fly, David Cronenberg's reimagining from 1986, based on the short story from the 50s, and then more widely known, the film from 1958, starring Vincent Price and David Hedison. So, what gives? Why are we going with The Fly instead of Island of Dr. Moreau? Well, we're still going to get to the Island of Dr. Moreau from 96, but that's going to be 2 weeks from now. So what ended up happening, let you in behind the curtain here, is that as of this recording, which is March 25th, 2025, Matt is in Mexico, and I'm gearing up for my own spring break vacation to sunny Iowa. With that said, you know, me and Matt decided, let's just push back Dr. Moreau. And wait until we can really commit ourselves to it. Frank Olson is going to join us there. Longtime listeners rejoice for the return of Frank. So I thought to myself, you know, we do have a back catalog at this point on Camp Kaiju, which is a really great luxury. Like we're very proud of our show and our content. And what you're going to hear is our recording of The Fly 1986 originally released October 2021. So what, 3.5 years ago? That's insane. It's also the first time Matt appeared on this here podcast. So it's also just kind of a trip back through time. Me and Matt, before we had any sort of script, before we had any sort of inside jokes, it's just he and I, we had met, he and I had personally met years ago. We worked together, but for The Fly, for this episode you're going to hear, we recorded it originally on Instagram. Yeah, we did an Instagram live show, and that's how I was recording Camp Kaiju at that time. Boy, how times have changed, and we couldn't thank the patrons enough out there for allowing that change to continually develop. So I got a shout out, Jason, Chris, Sean, our anonymous patron, Peggy, and our brand new patron, Will. If you're out there listening, thank you for your contributions every month. It really keeps us going. And if you, Will, and everyone else listening, you know, you go back to season one, go back to season two of Camp Kaiju. The audio is not great. I'm going to own up to that. I was just starting out my podcast journey. I was recording myself on my phone. I was uploading these to Instagram, to YouTube, and occasionally I was going live with a special guest. Case in point, Matthew Cole Levine. We'd worked together. We'd been friends together. I knew he was a movie buff and a film critic and had a lot of really interesting and good takes on the horror genre, specifically science fiction monster movies. So Matt, as you'll soon hear, is a huge fan of Cronenberg, and This Fly in particular is one of his favorite movies. You know, it's not a spoiler to say this is a highly regarded masterpiece to many people, and I can't argue with those points. So we hope you enjoy, and we hope you forgive any audio qualities that are less than what you're used to with more recent seasons of Camp Kaiju. Now, while Cronenberg's Fly may be an undisputed marvel of a film, and the 58 Fly, I would say, is equally in those ranks for very different reasons, but please check that movie out if you haven't. But I can't wait to get into a little bit of my own personal takes on the sequels in this bizarre franchise. Listeners, I gotta tell you, you have your Frankensteins, have your Freddy Kruegers, but when it comes to horror franchises, I think The Fly, this is a 5-film franchise, is underrated, and just through and through, apart from the two bona fide classics, these sequels, we have Return of the Fly from 1959, Curse of the Fly from the mid-60s, and then Fly 2, which is the sequel to Cronenberg's Fly. These movies offer so much to dive into, to buzz about, and really analyze. They run the gamut from good, bad, and campy, which is our bread and butter here on Camp Kaiju. So that's what I really love, those kinds of movies. I'm going to talk about them a little bit here in order, but I want to just go into some nuts and bolts before I do that. I do want to thank you truly for listening this week. I know it's a surprise episode, but please rate and review wherever you listen. That really goes a long way in increasing our audience, which, again, I'm proud of the work we put out, and I'm proud of the little community we have created here on Camp Kaiju. You know, I read all the reviews I can on YouTube, on Instagram, on Spotify. I always try to respond, and even if out there you're not always agreeing with what me and Matt say, I really appreciate the back and forth conversations that then leads to. Because, you know, we don't love every movie, and not everyone out there agrees that what I think is a masterpiece is. And I love that. I love that conversation. I love that film and art can do that. And here we are talking about The Fly, all the flies, which, you know, I think to varying degrees speak to that complicated, wonderful place that art can inhabit, where it is both popular and artistic, right? So it can be loved by audiences and respected by critics. And I think The Fly as a franchise, as a series, just hits that sweet spot so well. And I love it. I love it. So truly, thank you for listening. If you have any thoughts, opinions, questions, or memories about The Fly, any of these movies, please let us know. You can send listener comments to campkaiju@gmail.com, our Instagram page at camp_kaiju_podcast, or call us. Please leave us a voicemail at 612-470-2612. And we'll feature your voice on the show. So please check all that out in our show notes. CampKaijuPodcast.com is also a wonderful place. And you know what? The best place is our Patreon. So check that out. The more patrons we get, the more perks and prizes we can offer. So it's pretty exciting over at Camp Kaiju this year. We truly appreciate it. Of course, you can buy some merch, t-shirts, magnets, coasters, mugs, mouse pads, you name it. CampKaiju.threadless.com can offer you a whole lot of really interesting things. So, speaking of Patreon, I just want to go back to that for a second. On May 5th at Indeed Brewing in Minneapolis, Minnesota, me and Matt will be co-hosting Film Friends Movie Trivia with Naomi Osborne. This is her once a month event over at Indeed, where she hosts and curates a movie trivia night. It's a blast. Talk about community. Same people go every month. I've enjoyed every time I've gone, and I'm honored. Me and Matt are both honored to be behind the table May 5th, coming at you with some monster movie trivia, of course. So if you are in town, please stop by and you'll get a free drink, alcoholic or not, on us, on Camp Kaiju, for patrons. So become a patron between now and May 5th, 2025, and you're good for a free drink. So why pass that up? And of course, if you're not in town, if you become a patron between now and then, we'll make it up for you. We'll come up with something else, another freebie. Because, hey, patrons, you're the foundation for all this. So thanks so much.
Will everyone in the theater hold on firmly to his seat, please? I'm Vincent Price. What unearthly horror did that girl gaze upon? What manner of incredible thing walked beneath that hood? It would be unfair at this time to show you any more of what went on in that laboratory where a man actually dared to play God. So fantastic, words can't begin to describe it. You must see it with your own eyes to believe it. When the fly comes your way.
Isn't like any other fly I've ever seen.
No! 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 Please, let me look at the fly! I've killed Andre. Please help me. Call the police and...
The charge can only be murder.
There were no mistresses. I had no lovers.
Why did you kill him?
God, don't let it get out.
Inspector. Inspector, it's in the garden. Come quickly.
As God is my witness, I saw the thing. It's unbelievable. I shall never forget that scream as long as I live.
The fly is on its way. Watch out for it. It's far beyond anything your mind could ever conceive.
Oh.
be unfair at this time to show you any more of what went on in that laboratory where a man actually dared to play God. So fantastic, words can't begin to describe it. You must see it with your own eyes to believe it. When the fly comes your way.
Listen. Do you hear? It's coming back. Turning the screen into a buzzing, crawling, creeping nightmare of terror. This is the son of the original fly, daring to explore the forbidden science of transmigration that brought horrible death to his father.
You look as if you've just seen a ghost, old man.
It was the fly.
Fear that will fasten its choking grip on you as his weird experiments spawn the twisted monstrosities of a living hell. The rat man whose hands and feet are changed to paws. The living corpse who rose from his coffin. And the return of the fly, seeking revenge with 1,000 eyes. Smashing anything that stands in his way.
Suppose he does come here. What if Philippe does not have the mind of a human, but the murderous brain of the fly?
Then he will have to be destroyed.
Shock that can't be stopped.
You're not God. You're not even human. You murdered those men and you made me a murderer too.
Weird experiments of accursed scientists turn human beings into living hybrid hell monsters. Now you hold hands with the devil. Now you run. Run for your life from the terror, the torment, the torture inflicted by Satan's ambassador of evil. The next victim could be you. Or you. Or you. Caught forever by the curse of the fly.
Return of the Fly from 1959. Now, why don't I start with The Fly from 58? Well, me and Matt actually recorded a brief podcast episode on that movie back in 2021. So I recommend going back into the history books and listen to that episode when you get done with this one. But we haven't talked about any of the sequels. And of course, you know, I'm going to offer my 2 cents here, but not at the expense of Matt's valued input. So, you know, listeners, if you like what you hear just a little bit here, let us know if you want some full episodes on these bad boys, because trust me, we're happy to oblige. But Return of the Fly from 1959. As I write on Camp Kaiju's Letterboxd, it is an effective sequel that continues the storyline of the Delambre family, whereby the son follows in the doomed footsteps of his scientifically ambitious father. The fact that the son is destined for Flyville is no surprise, but how he gets there offers enough unexpected thrills. The crime elements of the film are tightly directed and compellingly played. Vincent Price keeps it straight, and Brett Halsey as Philippe is a dynamic screen presence. By the end, however, this drama lurches into camp with the revelation of the fly. It's almost impossible not to, with makeup costume limitations as they were. Folks, even the first fly, acclaimed as it is, features some unintentional humor. Nevertheless, it's a giddy romp through the woods. Oh, and this is a spoiler, and the hamster with hands will live in your nightmares rent-free. Ugh. Overall, Return of the Fly plays it safe, but manages to deliver some intrigue, shock, and charm along the way. Hamster with hands, y'all. That's all I have to say. A really bizarre moment of surrealist horror. Like it's weird and wild. I didn't expect it in a black and white 50s ostensibly B movie, but there it is. Return of the Fly. Check it out. And then for the really ambitious of you, it just calls for a double feature with 1965's Curse of the Fly. Now, this one does contain spoilers, so feel free to fast forward a couple minutes here. But here we go. Now, the lack of flies in Curse of the Fly isn't necessarily the problem, but the advertising that sells fly mayhem to no avail. The movie seems to build up to the unexpected show-stopping moment of science gone wrong until nothing. Literally, the protagonist fades away and you're left feeling the same about this movie. Still, there are several sequences worth highlighting. The eerie opening is an effective hook. Perhaps the film peaks too soon with this. The reveal that Father has been lost in space is horrifying. And the body horror of two men being spliced together foreshadows Cronenberg's later take on the material and so much other 80s body horror. Overall, however, Curse of the Fly seems so willing to set itself apart from its predecessors that it fails to deliver a worthy sequel, much less a standalone feature. Now, before I get to Fly 2 from 1989, I gotta say Return of the Fly and Curse of the Fly, they offer up legitimate body horror at a time period where I am not used to seeing such effects. Curse of the Fly in particular, there is a puppet. It's not an animatronic. I'm sure it's done with like air pumps and valves, but there's some sort of prop that is two male human naked bodies conjoined. Something you'd way more expect to see in the 80s, right? Like with Carpenter's The Thing or Cronenberg's films. And the fact that you're seeing it in the 60s black and white cheapo B movie, I think is ahead of its time. And whatever faults I have with Curse of the Fly and even Return of the Fly, the fact that you're seeing truly unsettling visual effects, it's worth the price of admission. So if you can, please rent Curse of the Fly and Return of the Fly. My personal preference is Return of the Fly, a more faithful, straightforward sequel to The Fly that continues the story. Curse of the Fly is a bit controversial in that regard, and everyone seems to have an opinion on it. So I'd love to hear yours. But let's find my Letterboxd take on The Fly 2 from 1989. So this follow-up to Cronenberg's preceding masterpiece self-assuredly goes its own route, leaning into more action and less idiosyncrasies. After all, we have already seen the gruesome transformation of man into Brundlefly. Rather, Fly 2 offers up imagery involving cocoon sacs and a bipedal monster more like Jurassic Park's Velociraptor than the fly monster from before. All of this is brought to life with impressive special effects. Where the film suffers is the overtness of it all. Actors play sad, angry, scared. It's difficult to explain, but compelling acting is all about less, not more. Additionally, the script is laughably ham-fisted in moments as the screenwriter clumsily fills in exposition. These deficiencies eliminate any emotional connection to the life and death stakes of the characters. Overall, without its famous pedigree, I fear Fly 2 would be borderline forgettable, lost in the milieu of 80s effects-driven horror films. However, as an entry in one of the strangest franchises out there, it's a worthy addition. It's a worthy addition. How would I rank the flies? I mean, there's five of them. I guess I'd go Cronenberg's Fly, the 58 Fly, Return of the Fly. I think I gotta go Fly 2 and then Curse of the Fly. But those bottom two, I could mix and match. Now, not that any of these movies are unwatchable. Even Curse of the Fly and The Fly 2 have their moments. Like I said, they're worth checking out again just for the conversation and to think about maybe what could have been, what turns and twists could have been better. But they're not boring by any means. So definitely worth a watch. In current monster movie news, you know, if you Google new Fly movie, of course there's something kind of in the works from 20th Century Studios. Nikiatu Jusu, apologies if I'm mispronouncing that, but Nikiatu Jusu is a writer-director, and she is developing a new Fly based on Cronenberg's edition. Now, this is reportedly not a sequel, but also not a remake, maybe its own interpretation of the film. Oh, I don't know. I'm looking at an article from Deadline right now from November 2024. It says the film's plot is under wraps. However, it is again from Jusu, who's one of a closely watched genre filmmaker. She directed a horror film called Nanny that debuted at Sundance not too long ago. She is working for Monkey Paw and Universal and seems to be dipping her toes into a lot of horror themed films. So I don't know. I mean, I would love to see new Fly movies. It's been a while. I think this film and this series are ripe for interpretation, you know, science versus nature, humanity versus corporations. There's a lot of critique of capitalism in these movies and the pursuit of knowledge for wealth's sake rather than maybe the betterment of society. But then you get really campy aspects like teleportation and little insects with human faces that honestly are so weird. Truly the stuff of nightmares. So if you've only ever seen one Fly movie, there's so much more for you to dig into. I'm excited for you. I'm excited for this journey. I want to talk about it. So yeah, that's where I'm going to leave this little intro to this re-release of me and Matt's previous conversation. So thanks for sticking it out. Enjoy the content. Let us know what you think. So until next time, when we come at you with The Island of Dr. Moreau, what else can I say but stay campy?
Listen. Do you hear it? It's getting closer. Much closer. Don't be afraid. Be very, very afraid.
You could finish your father's work. You're as brilliant as he was.
Something odd is happening to me, and I don't know what it is.
I'm getting worse.
I'm getting better.
The Fly, too. Like father, like son.
Hello, and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Talk. Tonight, we are going live to discuss the next installment of our September series, For the Love of Craft, looking at not just Lovecraft adaptations, but movies that still kind of play in that same lane of not just cosmic horror, but maybe science gone awry. At the very most, it's a wide umbrella. This series is just looking at practical effects and, you know, the love people have for their craft. So tonight we have a very special guest, buddy of mine, a film critic, aficionado, essayist, His name is Matt Levine, and I'll be bringing him on here in just a second to discuss David Cronenberg's The Fly. Here we go. All right, we will just... There he is. How you doing, Matt?
Good, how are you?
Awesome.
Good.
So glad you're here.
Yeah, thank you. It's good to be here.
I love your background. It looks rather spooky.
Yeah, that's what I was going for. This is our front porch in our house, and we're excited to start decorating it for Halloween. So it's almost that time of year.
You don't have to do much to decorate.
Indeed. Yeah, our favorite part of the house.
No offense. I am itching to start decorating for the season.
Yeah, my favorite time of year is the best holiday. I mean, it's a good excuse to watch at least one horror movie a day. So I'm so excited. It's almost October.
So I went to the library today where I checked out a whole bunch of classic, like, black and white horror movies that I've never seen before. And, well, I wanted to run them by you and get your gut reactions.
I'm excited.
Okay. Actually, this one I have seen before. We have talked about Cat People.
So good. It's a masterpiece of suggestion, and Jacques Tourneur is one of the best, like, visual stylists of classical Hollywood horror. It's so good, and, you know, I think, like, what it gets at in terms of sexuality and sort of, like, the danger, but also the excitement of it, is so great, and goes a little bit over the top in the Paul Schrader remake from the 80s, which also must be seen to be believed, but, yeah, Cat People is the best. It's such a good movie.
Awesome. A little sneak peek for people watching. I want to, in October... I want to do a series about classic black and white monster movies. And Matt, I wanted to ask you, like, I would love to, you know, chat with you about this movie, but also its sequel, The Curse of the Cat People, which I don't know if you've seen, but I'm interested in that too.
That's an awesome movie. It's a sequel in name only. In fact, they were sort of trying to capitalize on the success of Cat People. So they sort of brought in that appeal, but the story doesn't really have anything to do with the first film. It's kind of a little bit more about parenthood and, like, childlike imagination, and it's really, really great. I talk to you about it.
Well, yeah, let's make a plan. So my next movie is the aforementioned remake of Cat People.
It's like we planned it, but we didn't.
My expectations for this are low, but I'm going to give it a whirl at some point.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that your expectations should be low necessarily. Like, it's a really gorgeously beautiful movie. Really great score. There are some David Bowie songs, at least one David Bowie song on the soundtrack. Anastasia Kinski is really great. It's way over the top. It's really ridiculous, but no, sometimes that can only improve a movie. So I'm
all right. So maybe high on the camp factor with that one.
Yeah, a certain kind of camp for sure.
Here is a movie related to tonight, the 1950s Fly with Vincent Price. When have you seen this one?
It's been a long time. Probably about 15 years now. And to date myself a little bit, that was like one of my first years in college as an undergrad. So it's been a while. Probably should have rewatched it for this conversation, but it's a little heavier on the camp for sure.
Yeah,
certainly in relation to the David Cronenberg version, but you gotta love it. I mean, if you're a fan of 50s horror.
Yeah, I haven't seen it since I was a kid, so I'm excited to watch that one. Another Vincent Price movie. I kind of went on a Vincent Price deep dive here. I have The Tingler, which I know is a cult classic from the 50s. It just looks and sounds gross. So...
You can't go wrong with that title.
I don't. And that's like an earwig. I don't know. It looks gross.
I think I haven't seen that one since high school. So that's been even longer, but that's really good.
And this one, Vincent Price is a very small part, early role. It's called The Tower of London with Basil Rathbone and Boris Karloff from 1939, I think. I don't know. Looks creepy and dark, atmospheric. And then, speaking of dark houses, I have The Old Dark House.
Love that movie.
Do you? I've wanted to see this for a long time.
It's so good. James Whale, one of my favorite like old school horror directors. Yeah, and sort of like Bride of Frankenstein, the old Dark House is a great mixture of comedy and horror. It's really short. It's like 1 hour and 5 minutes. So good. It's really good. Right. I might flip it off on that.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you want to come over, like, let's watch them. We'll get to The Fly. Yeah, I've just been, I've always wanted to see, like, the 30s type horror movies outside of the classic monsters. Like, The Old Dark House or Freaks or The Black Cat, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. There's some good stuff. White Zombie is really good.
Yeah, I want to see that.
That one's great. Dr. X, I just watched recently. Mm-hmm. That's a really strange movie because it had like a 3-strip Technicolor process that was like used way back in the day, and then they stopped using it in the early 30s. So it's like a very old color movie that has this weird surreal look where all the colors are sort of faded and sort of dreamlike. That's a really cool movie.
Neat. So I was only limited by what the library had. I can stream all these, but I checked out like too many movies from the library. So The Fly, to turn our attention to an 80s remake of a 50s classic. Just a quick little summary on Letterboxd. The tagline, first of all, is "Be afraid, be very afraid," which I didn't know was from this movie. It's just one of those lines that I didn't know where it came from. So it goes, when Seth Brundle makes a huge scientific and technological breakthrough in teleportation, he decides to test it on himself. Unbeknownst to him, a common housefly manages to get inside the device, and the two become one. That's about it. That's it in a pod.
It's accurate and yet does not convey the full freakish extent of this movie.
So we're going to talk about the good, the bad, and the downright campy when it comes to this film. We'll start with the good, because why not? actually, one of the good notes I had about this movie is related to what you just said about, like, it tells you exactly what that is, but at the same time, nothing. I found a lot of the suspense with this movie came because I knew exactly what was going to happen. I knew he was going to turn into a fly, but how it got us there kept me on my toes the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, to me, like, this movie's like 96% good. This is one of my favorite horror movies and my favorite David Cronenberg movie, so I think it's almost entirely good.
Uh-huh.
Almost no movie is perfect, but this movie is so ambitious, and I, like, it's a good example of why horror is my favorite genre, because that storyline that you just said is, you know, it scratches the surface of what this movie is sort of trying to get at in terms of, like, what is a human being and, like, where does the human body end and, like, other bodies begin? And that's body in, like, many different senses of the word, animal bodies or, like, machine bodies and things like that. I think it's about disease. I think it's about, you know, like, humanity's sort of desire to be better, and that sort of destroys them in the end. It's a really sad movie, but also really disgusting and gory, and that's kind of a perfect combination, I think.
It was doing quite a number on my heartstrings. It was, like, super sad, but then, like, really wretched and vile at the same time.
Yeah. The best. My favorite combination.
Yeah. It has a ton of heart. Like, really sincere. It's got a lot. The love story is sincere. Like, I totally buy that between Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum. Another big thing I love about it is how it's not a simple movie by any means, but I felt like the performances and the direction were so incredibly understated that it sold all the absurdity that's really happening, but you buy it because of the understated way it's all being delivered.
Yeah, absolutely. With such a ridiculous premise, it's kind of amazing that they pulled that off. But
right.
Yeah, I think it is kind of rooted in, you know, sort of human motivations or feelings or whatever, because, you know, like, I think ambition, again, is, you know, hubris, whatever, like, if you want to the old school literary term. Like, Jeff Goldblum like wants to create this earth shattering invention that will change science and change the world as we know it. And Gina Davis is a journalist who wants to, you know, be in on this huge story. And again, like ultimately that does destroy them, which probably isn't a surprise to anybody who knows anything about the movie. But yeah, I think that's really relatable. And like the fact that they sort of just like stumble into this together and do very quickly sort of, you know, develop feelings for each other, probably partially because of their shared ambition and their like desire to like sort of make an impact with their lives. And then it all goes horribly awry. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It makes it way more, you know, relatable and engrossing than, you know, most viewers probably would expect.
Yeah, and especially because it is at its roots, the roots of this film is a B movie, and like that's part of the fun, I think, too. When you are familiar with B movies from like the 50s, and you're confronted with a real auteur film like The Fly, it's still fun to see where even a movie as well thought out as this is still leaning into the tropes and still like just like camouflaging the tropes in something very artistic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. Yeah. And it's like the tagline, I think, is kind of a good example of that, because
yeah,
the moment that it's spoken by Gina Davis, when she says, "Be afraid, be very afraid," it's sort of out of place. Like, it's a pretty intense scene and you don't really expect it, but it's sort of comedic and it like alleviates the tension a little bit, you know. It's perfect. Yeah. That's like one of the best examples of that combination, I think.
Right. And the fact that we're dealing with a mad scientist, I mean, he gets there like when the fly genome is affecting him. He is a mad scientist. They're so great. I comment on this on 50s science fiction movies all the time. There's always a scene where the scientist just says a bunch of mumbo jumbo that you just buy it because the story needs you to buy it. And it's like, great, that explains it. And there was a part where Jeff Goldblum said some mumbo jumbo and, okay, great, we're on this train.
Yeah. You know, I've always been a strong supporter that a little bit or a lot of suspension of disbelief is the best way to approach any movie. So I'm definitely okay with
it. Yeah, I'm okay with it too. It was awesome.
It's pretty cool too to see like the like old school technology in this movie from 1986. Like, you know, like the old computers and the sort of like program that he invents to sort of like fuse these different DNA sequences. Yeah. It's kind of a marvel of like, you know, primitive analog like computer technology.
That's true.
It's cool.
Like, sorry.
No, that's all I was gonna say. It's cool to see. It's great like set design and great special effects and all that.
Oh well, in terms of the set design, I think this movie is. It's rare that I see a production design as detailed as this. Like the set dressings, the costumes, the props, like everything was so meticulously intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything come to your mind, any examples of that kind of stuff?
No, I definitely agree. I mean, I think this again goes back to what you were just talking about, but his like rapid descent from like a mostly normal human being, like sort of an oddball but still like quirky and like just a scientist, you know. Mm-hmm. Like not anything really threatening or whatever, like rapidly into like you said, mad scientist realm, where his like he has this loft in, I think it was shot in Toronto. I guess we don't know exactly where the movie is set, but yeah, he has this loft, which is like sort of run down in kind of like a cool, like bohemian way at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then like so rapidly, but so believably, like it just becomes like a lair that's like filled with like garbage and like rotting meat. And then eventually like his own rotting body parts. And like, it gets more and more gross, you know,
yeah.
Like perfectly done. Yeah.
It's a total, horror nightmare setting.
Yeah.
You could believe that like Michael Myers is in that warehouse.
Yeah,
you know, it's awesome. Yeah, I was gonna comment on the same vein, like the costuming also clearly like tracks the character development just through the costuming. There's a part where he's wearing a bomber jacket like this, And I was like, oh, because he's a fly, because he's flying. I don't know if I'm reading into it, but I think that was intentional.
Yeah, for sure. And I think just the fact, too, that he, like, wears the same clothes every day, as Gina Davis points out in the movie. And she, like, looks in his closet, and it's, like, the same blazer, the same pants that he wears, like, every single day. And then, like, throughout the course of the movie, you know, starts to break away from that, starts to, like, change up his wardrobe a little bit.
Right.
A sign of a sort of, like, you know, freakish confidence as he starts to get a little more strong. And then, obviously, that goes downhill from there. But, yeah, you're right. The costuming is, like, really sort of subtle and, like, says a lot about the characters, for sure.
Yeah. Do you want to transition into some challenging aspects, some things that maybe didn't quite work for you? I know this is, like, your favorite movie, so it might be tough for you, but what are some things that kind of stand out to you?
Yeah, it is sort of tough for me, but there are some things for sure. I guess, like, what I think is a strength of the movie could be seen as a flaw, which is that, like, the narrative is, like, so lean and tight and concise. There's not, like, a single moment that's, like, filler or, like, extraneous. Like, we start with Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis meeting each other. Like, that's the very first scene. And the very last scene, and not to give it away too much, but there's nowhere you can really go after that. So I guess, you know, some people could consider it sort of a criticism that it's just, like, it seems simple on the surface. Like, it really is just, like, the story of a man turning into a fly, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Incorrect. I think there's so many sort of subtexts built into that plot. Yeah. But so I guess maybe that doesn't count. I think, like, maybe a more valid criticism is the question of, is David Cronenberg a misogynist or a sexist filmmaker? I think in some other of his movies that does, like in The Brood, for example, like he wrote and directed that movie when he was going through a bad divorce. And, like, that movie sort of is about, like, an angry ex-wife who creates, like, a spawn of hellish children. So I do think that accusation holds up with The Brood. Mm. And in The Fly, there's, like, the nightmare sequence where Gina Davis gives birth to, like, a huge maggot. And it depends, which is pretty disgusting. It depends on how you read that. Like, I think it could be read as sort of like, you know, like motherhood and childbirth is disgusting. Or I don't think that's accurate. I think the way it could be read is that, weirdly enough, it's kind of a metaphor for abortion. The fact that it's kind of like a weirdly a pro-choice movie unexpectedly, because she needs to abort her baby. She knows that it's sort of dangerous for her. And there's a lot of sympathy for her in those scenes. So I read something about The Fly that sort of raised that question. But I think there's actually a lot of very difficult and sort of, it leads to some gruesome areas. But there's a lot of sympathy for the Gina Davis character in this movie, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about Cronenberg. If his other works speak to a sort of misogyny, I think The Fly had, like, some of the male characters are douchebags, but that's their character. Like, that's fine. Like, you know, but as Gina Davis is treated, like you said, I think she's treated like a strong, independent woman who's just trying to, you know, do what she can. And she falls in love with a fly man. So, you know,
you do. Yeah.
She's just a woman trying to survive.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think it's totally, I don't think it's a valid criticism to The Fly, personally.
No.
But on the other hand, the sequel to this movie, maybe that is a little more accurate, but that's a conversation for a different time.
I am slightly shocked that there are as many Fly movies, like, just in total in the world, as there are.
And still not enough, in my opinion.
I want to watch them all with you and just, like, marathon all literally the good, the bad, and the campy.
Yes. Yeah. Right. I would love to hear what your take on The Bad and The Fly is, because I think your response was a little more mixed than mine.
No, I echo you. I think it's so tight that, and it's nitpicking, but you know, it does force your mind to make certain narrative leaps when, like, as they're falling in love, for instance. It's like, oh, that happened fast. Or in the bar when he literally snaps a man's arm in half and there's no consequences. He's just like, well, all right, moving on. But no, you would be in jail. There would be massive consequences to that. But that would be a different movie. Like, that's not the movie. So, you know, you get it. You buy it. You know, suspension of disbelief. I'm nitpicking, but
yeah, no, there are some plot holes for sure. I try to think of it like if I was an audience member, like watching that other potential movie or whatever, like, that would be kind of boring. Like, I don't really want to see like sort of him in jail for a while or whatever, you know? So
no, yeah.
I'm okay with stuff like that.
That derails the narrative that we're on completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point for sure.
Yeah. But that's all I got, really. I had to struggle to find bad things about this movie.
And I'm happy to hear that since I love this movie so much. I guess, like, it is pretty depressing. I guess maybe somebody who wasn't really expecting that. Like, I feel like it gets... Again, I would put this in the good category, but I feel like towards the end, it gets a little bit into the territory of, there's this great line, I wish I remembered it verbatim, but Jeff Goldblum basically says, I was an insect who dreamed he was a human and it was beautiful, but then the dream ended and the insect awoke. I think the line is something like that. Yeah. My favorite line in the movie. And yeah, it's really kind of brutally sad on like an existential level. Like, are humans any better than flies or insects, or are we all just made of like the same base impulses or whatever? Like, it's a fascinating idea that I think horror does really well, and I love that this movie goes there, but it is pretty surprisingly bleak and depressing.
Right. So that's like, you know, this goes into the territory, like, if it's not your cup of tea, that's fine, because not only is it existentially depressing, it's gross. It's got a lot of like gross out body horror, which we love. It enhances the story we're telling, but I could see if you're squeamish, there are some rather squeamish moments in this film.
Yeah, it's not for the lighthearted. That is
no. Definitely. And I think, like, I can handle it, but man, I was taken aback a little bit by some moments. And just how honestly good the practical effects are.
Yeah, yep. Oscar winning by Chris Wallace, I think his name is, the makeup effects. Yeah, really, really great. The Fly 2, I know I brought it up before. It's not a good movie, but it is an extremely gory movie. So beware of that whenever you do watch it.
I'll get there at some point. So what? Let's move on to like the downright campy. I got something in mind, but what do you have in mind? Something that was like really silly and fun, just campy.
I love the moment when he's in full-on like transformation mode and his body's falling apart, and Gina Davis, her character, comes over to his loft late in the film and he is trying to eat a donut and he just vomits onto it. And it's really gross, and then he looks at her and he's like, oh, that's disgusting, which is what everybody's thinking, of course. Such a great way to like break up the horror and the disgustingness of that moment. I don't know. I wouldn't say that's campy per se, but it definitely injects some sort of silly humor into it, I guess. Which
my God. So, and it's so needed too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good thing about Goldblum's character. Like, he keeps a sense of humor throughout, which again, alleviates some of that existential depression.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You have to laugh, because what else are you going to do? Like, it's just completely miserable otherwise. So, yeah, it's much better.
That was good. I just keep going back to, where is he getting these baboons? Every time you turn around, there's another baboon in the laboratory.
Yeah, you got to feel for him, yeah. I would, you know, like, there is like a tiny bit of explanation because he works for this research lab. So maybe he's like getting them through the lab. But you would think at some point they're like, we're spending thousands of dollars on these baboons that he's killing. Like, they would probably stop approving that, you know, him using them for the experiments.
And see, actually, if this movie, like, we're, you know, it's so lean, this is an example of, if it was a little bit longer, we might have a scene where he is picking up the baboon, like, it explains the baboons, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I would like to see that for sure.
Yeah, because otherwise it comes off as, you know, really campy and silly, like, whoa. You don't just go to the pet store and pick up a baboon.
Jeff Goldblum can, apparently.
Like, they're not dogs or rats. He uses baboons.
Like maybe in a way that is kind of like a campy throwback to like old mad scientist movies where they did have these like strange sets where they just have like potions, animals and everything everywhere, you know? Like,
that's true. Chimpanzees.
Sorry, what's that?
Chimpanzees in cages.
Yeah, right, exactly, which they do their experiments on. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like for the most part, I think the remake of The Fly does a really good job of sort of like not being too ironic or like winking or anything like that, you know? But
yeah,
like little moments like that where I think it gives props to its forerunners.
Yeah, and like that's why I love film so much, film history. Like when you consume so many movies, you can see those hallmarks of an earlier era, maybe. You know, not everyone will get, but certain people can appreciate if they know the forerunners.
Yeah, for sure. This is a diversion, but I know you and I were talking about the remake of The Blob recently.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of that, too. Like, I love the remake of The Blob way more than I thought I would. And it comments on the original in some pretty cool ways.
Yeah. I feel like as I've been doing this series and just Camp Kaiju in general, like the 1980s, there was clearly a phase where they wanted to remake 50s movies. Because you have this, The Fly, The Blob, The Thing. There was an Invasion of the Body Snatchers in the late 70s, but you can throw that in. Yeah, it was just like, let's remake our favorite movies that we grew up on, but now that we have like real effects to pull off, you know, what they were trying to do back then.
Yeah, and are maybe a little bit more willing to go into like the dark subject matter that like had to sort of like hint at a little bit more, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's cool to see. And I, you know, with The Thing, I love John Carpenter. What was the, sorry, you just mentioned another remake, which I totally forget now. You mentioned, Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
If I remember right, that late 70s one was by Don Siegel. I could be wrong about that, but he's like a good action thriller suspense director. So, you know, normally I'm like not into remakes or sequels all that much like nowadays, but
yeah,
those 80s horror movies, like it's maybe my favorite category of movie.
It's a really fascinating time, I think, in movie making.
Yeah.
Well, my friend, is there anything else? I think we should like give our final summation. You know, I think this movie's a classic. I think it stands the test of time because of these themes, these universal themes, love, loss, aging, female empowerment, surprisingly, you know, women's body rights. I think it says a lot and still manages to wink a little bit at the fun cheesiness that it's inherently made of.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's definitely its own thing while it is kind of like taking this sort of well-known story and sort of envisioning like what would happen if this actually played out in human terms, if a man became a fly.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a smart movie. It's really like you said before, visually understated, but it builds this atmosphere of dread so well. There's just a lot of, you know, like blacks and silvers and sort of muted colors, great performances. You know, I know that when this movie came out, it was sort of read as an allegory for AIDS, which I think is really interesting because it's out in 86. And it is definitely about sort of, you know, the breakdown that a human body undergoes during disease. And that can extend to any situation where, you know, a loved one is going through a serious illness. So there's so much to this movie. In lieu of rambling about it more, I'll just say that it will always be one of my favorite horror movies, and it's a pleasure to talk about.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to talk about more. Let me know, like, come October if you want to get together for Cat People. I'd love to do that, and its sequels. Yeah, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I look forward to talking to you next time.
All right. Get out of here, and I'll wrap up.
All right. See you later. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Wow. And thank you all for hanging out with me and Matt. We talked about The Fly, David Cronenberg's 1986 classic. Matt and I were both in accordance on that one. It says so much universally that I think just is as relevant today as it is in the 80s. So do check that one out. If you see any of the sequels, you know, hit me up and let me know. Those are definitely on my to-watch list. In the meantime, next week, I will be chatting about The Thing, John Carpenter's 1982 classic, with a very special guest, a friend of mine from the Mysterious Old Radio Listening Society, which is an awesome podcast where they kind of do this sort of format with old-timey radio and specifically horror radio. So my buddy there is very familiar with The Thing and Lovecraftian horror. I'm very excited to feature him on Camp Kaiju. So thank you so much. Like, follow, engage. There's a link to the merch in my bio. You can get this shirt if you want. Not this one, but maybe another one. And check us out on Letterboxd as well. All right, thanks, friends. Have a good night. Have a great week.
Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend. Subscribe to the website and send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com, Instagram, YouTube, links in the show notes. Or if you'd like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Please check out campkaijupodcast.com for more information. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul with Meanie's Mailbox music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thank you, friends, and until next time, stay campy.
How does Brundlefly eat? Well, he found out the hard and painful way that he's very much the way a fly eats. His teeth are now useless because although he can chew up solid food, he can't digest it. Solid food hurts. So, like a fly, Brundlefly breaks down solids with a corrosive enzyme playfully called vomit drop. He regurgitates on his food, it liquefies, and then he sucks it back up. Ready for a demonstration, kids? Here goes.
Oh my God. My God.